The following Dominican University of California production has been brought to you by radio.dominican.edu.
Good evening. My name is Suresh Apabu. I am the Dean for Diversity and Equity at Dominican University of California. I am privileged to welcome you all to Dominican Unity and Diversity Events Week 2016. First of all, I want to begin by acknowledging the membership of the Diversity Action Group and their immense collaboration in executing and planning and executing all of the events this week. That includes a couple of student leaders as well, so I will begin with them. So Emmanuel Manny Cifuentes Machado, please stand up. Jessica Holliday, please stand up. Lauren Castro, please stand up. Casey Halcrow. Christina Mays is taking care of her child, so she could not be here. Chris Antons, who is also here. Henry Schreibman, who is planning for our event on Wednesday, so he could not be here. Jamie Kastner. Libby, I should say. Mohammed El Mastoubi, he is ill. He emailed me to say he cannot make it. Olivia Catholico should be here shortly, I presume. Rachel Drew, who's here. Raditya could not be here either, but she will be on Wednesday. Valele Stawiarski, I should say, is not here. And then Yan Jin, who's a professor from the business school, also could not be here. So thank you for acknowledging them. None of the events this week could have happened without their help and their collaboration and their cooperation. I also want to thank some of the administrators who've taken the time to be here. So let me acknowledge Associate Vice President Dr. Moshkan Beyman here. Another Associate Vice President, Dr. Ashley Finley, is here. And the Director of Global Education, Dr. Katie Bell, is here. I want to also thank the many of the faculty, friends, and supporters who are here, who have taken their time specifically to be here and actually made time to bring their classes here. I really appreciate it. And I also want to thank my class, my students from the leadership class. Thank you very much for taking the time to be here. I really hope this will be helpful for you. So, without further ado, let me first say that this person is a sophomore, a history major from Oakland, California, a young woman who learned how to overcome life's obstacles from a determined mother, who, as a result of joining the Black Student Union, has become inspired, empowered, and is committed to highlighting the daily good, that not only what famous people do, but also the good that everyday Black people do. I want to, with that simple introduction, bring to the stage someone who is going to introduce our keynote speaker for this evening. So I want you to give a big hand and welcome Jessica Holliday, the president of the Black Student Union at Dominican University.
Good evening, everybody. I am Jessica Holliday, the president of the Black Student Union. It is my great pleasure to introduce to you our keynote speaker for tonight's event, Ms. Elaine Brown. Kicking off our Unity and Diversity 2016 celebrations at Dominican University of California. Elaine Brown is the former leader of the Black Panther Party. The Black Panther Party began as an activist movement in Oakland, California during the 60s, representing Black power, Black unity, and Black pride. The party's political goals included better housing, jobs, and education for African American people. This year, the party is celebrating their 50th anniversary. In 1971, Ms. Brown became editor of the Black Panther paper. Ms. Brown was also the chairman of the Black Panther Party. Brown also ran twice for a position of the City Council of Oakland. Although Brown also was once again defeated, she won 44% of the vote. Ms. Brown is not just a social activist, but also a mother and music composer, having studied classical piano for many years. She has recorded 2 albums of original songs, one from Motown Records, Until We're Free, and her 1969 album, Seize the Time, which includes the Black Panther Party national anthem. Ms. Brown attended Temple University, UCLA, Mills College, and the Southwestern University School of Law. She is the author of The Condemnation of a Little Bee and A Taste of Power. Today, Elaine Brown is the executive director of Michael Lewis Legal Defense Committee. For 20 years, she has been working on an appeal for Michael, who was 13 years old when he was wrongfully committed in Atlanta, Georgia, for a murder he did not commit and sentenced to life in prison. She now resides in Oakland, California, and is CEO of a nonprofit organization in Oakland, California, and fights for the injustices of racial profiling and disproportionate incarceration rates of African American men. We are honored to have her here today on behalf of the Office of Diversity and Equity in the Diversity Action Group and the Black Student Union. Please welcome Ms. Elaine Brown.
I'm glad to see so many people came out on this rather dull evening. I want to thank the Black Student Union and the InterClub Council and the Diversity Action Group for bringing me here, and appreciate all of you coming to hear what I have to say. We're going to do some question and answer. I see there's some answers afterward. There's an enthusiasm here that I hadn't anticipated, because I thought it was getting kind of like, why are we here kind of a moment, but I see that there is some enthusiasm, so I hope you're going to have some good questions. I'm going to try to stick to my script, the timing, and then we'll take some questions and answers if you want to ask them. I want to say, first of all, that, you know, San Rafael or San Rafael, I know it's supposed to say San Rafael. I have trouble with that. But anyway, is a city of great significance to me. You know, on August the 7th of 1970, I was in Hanoi when Johnson, 17-year-old Johnson Jackson, stepped into history right here in San Rafael. Some of you may realize it or know the story that he entered the Marin County Courthouse that was designed by, of course, iconic architect Frank Lloyd Wright. Johnson produced a gun and passed out other guns to prisoners who were at a hearing there at the time, and they took hostages and made a demand to free the Soledad brothers by noon. They all took the hostages and everyone went out into a van. The hostages included the judge, the district attorney, and several jurors. When they got out to the van and got into the van, San Quentin guards and local police and local sheriffs opened fire on the van, killed the judge, 2 of the prisoners, including William Christmas and James McClain, and severely wounded other people, including the DA and a 3rd prisoner named Rochelle McGee, who is still in prison today. And then they killed Jonathan Jackson. Johnson was my friend. He was the brother of the field marshal of the Black Panther Party, George Jackson, and I still weep for his murder. And there was, not there, but part of this, Angela Davis, whom you probably know more about, who had championed the cause of the Soledad brothers and identified them as political prisoners. It was probably the first time we began to use this term, political prisoners. She was charged, of course, as a conspirator in all of the events of that day at Marin County Courthouse because she allegedly had provided the guns to Jonathan that were used in the kidnapping and all of the charges that fell from that. She escaped prosecution for quite a while, was placed on the FBI's most wanted list, ultimately captured, ultimately tried, and acquitted. So that was the Angela Davis case that most of you probably don't know very much. You just know there was Angela Davis, don't know much about Jonathan, don't know much about George. So I wanted to bring this out because San Rafael for us is burned into the memory of the movement, that is to say the freedom movement, the Black Liberation Movement, the Black Power Movement, the International Revolutionary Movement. A lot of it has to do with what went on here in 1970 and then later in 1971. George Jackson, who was Jonathan's brother, part of one of the Soledad brothers, had begun a prisoner movement. There were all of these other movements. George was only 18 years old when he was put into prison for an $80 robbery, $70 robbery, and was sentenced to 1 year to life. And he concluded after reading all the various philosophies and analyses that as he began to study that he actually was a victim and that he was trapped in a racist society that had put him in a position where he had used desperate means to survive. And so he was like other millions of other people, other blacks, behind the wall and on the other side of the wall. And he concluded that prisoners had a duty to fight the oppression that afflicted the whole society on both sides of the wall for the same human rights. And he ultimately joined the Black Panther Party and became the party's field marshal. In January of 1970, the year that Jonathan was killed there at Marin County Courthouse, a white guard at Soledad Prison was killed supposedly by black prisoners, and this was supposedly in retaliation for the fact that a white guard had killed two prisoners about 4 or 5 days before and had been completely exonerated. And George and two other Soledad brothers, Fleeta Brumgo and John Cluchette were charged with the guard's murder, and they were transferred to San Quentin, which is how they came to be in San Rafael, which San Quentin, you know, calls itself a separate little entity, but it's basically San Rafael. With the death of Jonathan in August of 1970, George became more intense and determined to promote the ideals of the Black Panther Party behind the wall and organize prisoners talking about let us settle our differences. So you had Latinos and whites and so forth that were being organized by George into one unit, which made it very, very dangerous because instead of fighting now, they were organizing against what they deemed a common oppressor and to fight for basic human rights inside the prison, which is simply food and clothing and health care and what have you. Even today, the same issues are raised. 1 year later, though, on August 21, 1 year later from Jonathan's murder, on August 21 of 1971, George was assassinated, as we say, in an alleged escape attempt from San Quentin. And then 1 month later, on September 9th of 1971, over 1,000 prisoners in Attica State Prison in New York seized control of the prison, took some hostages, and made certain demands for decent food, for health care, for education and so forth. No, I mean, they weren't demanding being released. They just did that. And they filled up this open yard with about 39 prison guards and some other employees of their hostages. And they held them there, and there was press from all over the world came, and you may have read about this. And they held them there for about 4 days. And then the governor of the state, Rockefeller, decided to end the whole thing by, under his order, state police and guards and prison guards from various places fired over 3,000 rounds of ammunition into the yard and killed 29 inmates and 10 guards. And that was one of the most significant prisoner uprisings in America. Now, the only reason I bring all of this up outside the fact that we're here in San Rafael is that this history is important to sort of understanding what I came to talk about, which, you know, sort of generally speaking, I'm using the theme of the condemnation of Little B, the title of the last book that I had that was published. Because the status of blacks in the United States today can be manifested in many ways, but most starkly in the non-percentage of prisoners that we have in America. 50% of the American prison population is black, while we only represent 13% of the overall population. Some people want to argue that it's maybe 40-some percent. I don't care. The bottom line is it's 50%. So And why is this important to anybody? It's important because black people remain at the bottom of life in America. And this is notwithstanding the Oprah Winfrey's and Obama's and whoever else is out there with some kind of apparent power or apparent wealth. Notwithstanding these individual cases, the majority of blacks, we as a group, remain at the bottom of life in the United States. And as a result, if we rise, then everyone will rise probably with us, as has happened in the civil rights movement when women gained rights and gained rights that we had talked about from the beginning. And where are we in 2016? We are 25% of the poor in the United States. We actually have the highest poverty rate of any group of people, higher than even so-called immigrant populations. We have doubled the unemployment rate of whites. We have black-owned business revenues represent less than 1% of all business revenues. We have the lowest home ownership rate, highest rate of homelessness, infant mortality rate, that doubled that of whites, maternal mortality rate, four times that of whites, breast cancer death rate, double that of white women, prostate cancer rate, 140% higher than white men. We are still being slaughtered on the street by the police, and again, we represent 50% of the prisoners. These were the same conditions that gave rise to what we call the freedom movement, SCLC, Dr. King, the Black Panthers, and so forth. We never thought of it as the civil rights movement or the Black Power movement. We thought of it as the freedom movement under the kind of sentiment of, oh, freedom, the song, great song, oh, freedom over me, and before I'll be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave. But when we look at the conditions today, in many ways they are worse, because today, as for incarceration, of course, we can call America the incarceration nation. We have only 5% of the world's population, but 25% of the world's prisoners are in America. We have the highest percentage and the highest number of prisoners of any country in the world, and blacks are the greatest number. So how did this happen? So I want to talk a little bit about Little B to give us an example. Little B was a kid who was living in Atlanta in 1997. He was arrested at 13 years old for a murder that he didn't commit. But before that, when he was 8 years old, he discovered that his house was the crack house and his mother was crack addicted. He lived in an area called the Bluff. The Bluff was one of those areas that people know. You know, you have Marin City here, so you ought to know what the Bluff is, right? Maybe you don't know what Marin City is. Well, what it used to be a minute ago before it became a little bit different than it different and than now, with some of the development that is going on there. But in Atlanta, in the Bluff at that time, the Bluff was an area where anyone could buy drugs of any kind, and you had college students from Georgia Tech and from Spelman and Morehouse because it was very near the Atlanta University Center there in Atlanta, and you just drive through the Bluff and pick up drugs, and you could buy anything from ecstasy. You could buy certain kinds, different kinds of weed, different kinds of, you could buy a powder cocaine, you could buy a crack cocaine, you could buy anything there in the Bluff. And the Bluff was notorious, and it was a really terrible neighborhood, a depressed area, where there were no commerce other than drug dealing and drug using. A lot of drug users were there too. And so, you know, I always tell people that in the Bluff, you had this one store where this incident that Michael ended up being convicted of took place. And you have a store where they're selling, you know, bologna and some cookies or whatever else is there, something, maybe some packaged hair, maybe a phone card or what have you. But you're not going to be getting any vegetables. I tell people, all these people that say, oh, black people need to eat better, you're not going to be a vegan living in the Bluff or any other place in the hood. That's not going to happen. You won't be getting any tomatoes in the Bluff. And so by the time his house became the drug house, Michael's older brother was basically his parent. His older brother was by then a dope boy. And he was a parent to his younger sister, who was only 5 years old when they discovered this, and he began to take her to school and take care of her clothes, because they would be able to go to school and get free food, thanks to the Black Panther Party, I like to add as a point of interest. But in any case, by the time he was 11, he was declared a deprived child, had been sent to a group home, ran away from another foster home, and had nothing really, and he ran back to the Bluff, where he worked with his brother to sell drugs at 11 years old and basically lived on his own, and he was called Little B. And so Little B was a drug dealer for 2 years. I asked him when I met him, I said, what did you do? You were homeless. What did you do for a place to live? He said, I was never homeless. I could always find somewhere to sleep. And so he was 11. I don't know, you have to be like a genius to figure out how to survive at 11 with nothing. And I've had people say to me later, well, why didn't he go back to school, as though that were really a serious option for a kid who had no one to take care of him and was abused in the last foster home he had been in. So by the time he's 13, in 1997, he's arrested for the murder of a man named Darryl Woods. The story is so ridiculous, I can't even begin to tell you, and you know, I could talk about it if anybody want to know the details of it, but the bottom line is he did not kill Darryl Woods. But when he was arrested, and this is how I became familiar, they put him on the front page of the newspaper, and he was a thug. He was a thug, a black thug, who had killed a good black father, who had simply come into that area with his wife and children to buy a soda. Nobody goes into the Bluff to buy anything but drugs. I just told you, all you're going to buy there is some cookies, some hair in a package, a beeper, or whatever it is, but you're not going to buy anything serious. And to say that you found this place in the middle of this neighborhood, and that's where you wanted to buy a soda, is bizarre. But that's not the real issue. There was never any real motive. They said that Michael approached the guy's car, and his wife went into the store, and he said, this is New Jack City, cut your lights. You know, they had a whole fantasy about a movie named New Jack City. You know, it was sort of like the Central Park Reapers case. I don't know if you recall that. They were said to have been wilding, and there were these black boys, and they were getting worse and worse and crazier and crazier. They'd beaten this woman almost to death, and she had been in a coma for a long time, and they were all convicted, 14 and 15-year-olds, and then after having spent 10 years in prison, they found the actual rapist, who was not young or black. And so that was the era when we were talking about all these bad black boys roaming the streets of America. He was tried by the first black DA in the state of Georgia. The assistant black DA was a black woman. All the witnesses were black. The crack dealers and the crack users that took the stand and said, yes, I saw him do it, I heard he did it, or whatever they said, and including a former narcotics cop named Curly Top, who took the stand. He was convicted and sentenced to life in prison. He was 14 years old. That was in November of 97. By December, he was in an adult facility called Alto. That's what we do here in America. He's been 20 years in prison now, and we are waiting for a parole board decision based on our petition. But this was, as I say, at the time, this was the age of crack, and this was the age of tough on crime. We were going to be tough on crime. Tough on crime meant black boys were the criminals, because people didn't think about other people as criminals. You know, there was a book called Dark Alliance. I don't know if you've read it. If you haven't, I hope you will, by a guy, a journalist of the San Jose Mercury News named Gary Webb. And he talks about the connection between the Iran-Contra thing coming out of that, the dumping of cocaine into the black community, starting in Southern California, going up to here in the Oakland area, and moving across the country. Because everybody knows that black people did not bring cocaine into America from Colombia, Peru, or Bolivia. We haven't had a boat, a train, or anything else. We haven't had a boat since Marcus Garvey, and that boat never sailed. So the Black Star Line never sailed. Now I think about it, I said, nobody in my neighborhood had crack. I didn't worry about people being on crack in my neighborhood, and there was one reason for that. And that reason was there wasn't any crack. And the reason that there was crack is because it was brought into this country, and we can look at the history of the CIA and Dark Alliances and the dumping of cocaine to support the Sandinistas, to support rather the Contras who were held up in Honduras to overthrow the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. And that was the reason for it. I mean, I know it seems complicated, but it was the way to finance the Contras after the United States Congress said that it would no longer support the Contras. And we remember the trial of Oliver North and all of that and try to tie these pieces together, because cocaine doesn't just appear in the quantities that it did. And poor people, black people who were selling cocaine went from maybe making $5 an hour at McDonald's to being able to make $5,000 a day. So it was like, wait, what should I do? Work at McDonald's or make $5,000 a day? Wasn't a very difficult thing. And this was the age of the super predator. We had the coming of the super predator, all kinds of articles being written by people like William Bennett, the Secretary of Education, and people like a guy, really weird guy named John DiIulio, and all kinds of criminologists who were writing stories about some younger and younger black boy that was becoming more and more vicious and was going to be killing. There would be a bloodbath in America, the coming of the super predator. That was exemplified in a 1994 Time magazine article that I saw that made me just weep. A cover featuring a boy named Yummy Sandifer. He was only 11 years old, and the headline was, "Too Young to Die, Too Young to Kill." And he had been, it had been claimed that he had tried to join a gang, had killed some little girl, and that the gang, he was going to tell the police about it, the gang killed him. Now, none of this was factual. We didn't have any for Yummy was dead, and nobody was arrested for his death, but a whole story existed on the front page of Time magazine, demonizing black boys, even as young as 11. And this gave rise to the era of Bill Clinton. You know, everybody, you know, black people used to think Bill Clinton was the first black president. Well, some black people did. People like Toni Morrison and people like Chris Rock would actually said Clinton was the first black president. And that was before anybody had ever heard of Obama. But Clinton came along as the first black president because he said he was not Bush. That was what everybody wanted. Don't be Bush. We'll vote for anybody but Bush. That was the slogan almost. And Clinton walked into the White House on anybody but Bush. But as it turns out, he wasn't not Bush. He was worse than Bush. And now people don't believe that. They somehow separate fact from memory and everything else, or they have another. So what Clinton does is he finally institutes the neoliberal agenda that had been begun by Reagan and Bush before him. And that agenda can be stated in one simple sentence. The age of big government is over. The age of big government is over. Remember when Clinton said that? Maybe you're too young to remember, but look it up. Clinton's elected in 1992, inaugurated in 93, not by November of 93. There he is standing in the pulpit, the very pulpit of the Church of God in Christ in Memphis, Tennessee, where Dr. King gave his last great speech. You know that one where he says, "I'm not fearing any man tonight. I've been to the mountaintop. Might not get there with you," all of that. That last great speech, and here is Clinton, as far as I'm concerned, desecrating this pulpit by standing there, talking to the black people, introducing his speech by saying how much he loved Bishop Somebody's barbecue. Just, I'm not even gonna get into the racism of that. And then standing there and saying to the people who were the blacks who were gathered there to listen to him speak, since everybody thought he was a black president, and saying, "You know, I look around today at what's going on in your communities, and I have to ask, if Martin Luther King were alive today and standing by my side, what would he say?" That's what Clinton said to the black audience that was there. And then he purported to answer what Martin Luther King would have said. And Martin Luther King, according to Clinton, would have said, "I died for your freedom, and look what you've done with it." And the black people just hung their head. "You're right. Look what we've done with it." And he says, "And you have all this black on black crime. You're talking about white people killing you. Nobody white is killing you. You're killing each other. And all these unwed teen mothers having all these babies, laying up and having children out of wedlock, and the complete breakdown of the black family." Everybody hung their head in shame and said, "You're right. This is our fault. This is not big government. It's not going to save us. We have to do something about ourselves." Now, the arrogance of that is beyond anything I can say, and the racism in it. Because there's one part of the analysis. You know, whenever you talk about something, you have to have a correct analysis. In order to have a correct analysis, you have to have used actual facts. So when you talk about Dr. King died for your freedom, this assumes that at some point after Dr. King's death or during this time, we black people were, quote, free in America. And so King was killed on April the 4th of 1968. Now, I joined the Black Panther Party a little after April the 6th of 1968 because I thought we were fighting for freedom. Because we said we were fighting for freedom, and Dr. King said we were still fighting for freedom. That's why he was organizing the Poor People's Campaign at that time, because we were fighting for freedom. So we knew that when he died, we weren't free. So, at least from our analysis. And so I'm trying to figure out at what point black people got freedom and messed it up between April the 4th of 68 and November of 1993, when Clinton purports that we somehow messed up our freedom by being some sort of by being inherently dysfunctional at black-on-black crime, unwed teen mothers, and the breakdown of the black family. Now, the breakdown of the black family, I think that happened back in the 1600s when you started snatching African people from the continent and bringing them here through the Atlantic slave trade into Jamestown when the country was founded in 1607, or the first colony was founded in 1607. Talking about black-on-black crime, the greatest amount of crime in America is white-on-white. And so these are the kinds of things we just accept. And I don't know what the effect of the unwed teen mother is supposed to mean. Like, is it okay if you're married? I'm not clear about what that's supposed to mean. But what it did mean is Clinton says, well, I'm going to help you black people, and I'm going to help America. We are tired of these bad black boys, these super predators, running around these streets, and we're going to help you, and we're going to pass the legislation, the amendment, 1994 amendment to the omnibus crime bill that we all know is a three strikes crime bill, and we're going to make sure we're going to get these bad boys off the street. And we're going to put them under an idea of a three strikes crime program. You cannot continue to keep going through our neighborhoods, these black communities, and killing people or stealing from people. So the way we're going to resolve that, we're going to put you in prison forever. We're going to just start doing different things. And there was his wife, aiding and abetting him and calling these boys, these super predators, calling them super predators. And we all knew she was talking about young black boys who needed to be, as we now know, she said, quote, brought to heel, which of course is the way we speak about how we train our dogs to obey. The three strikes crime bill that Clinton introduced that swept the nation and other state laws, certainly here first, as in vanguard with California with Wilson, that was the then governor, who I like to make note, took the bar four times before he passed. This ended the 100-year-old juvenile justice system because a part of the three strikes crime system was to include children as to be tried as adults for crime. Forget the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, which the entire world has signed onto, except for the United States has not ratified anything as the UN Convention, which forbids and prohibits children from being tried and adjudicated as adults. Even the little so-called child murders in Rwanda. I mean, even the ignorant, savage Rwandans don't see children as adults. This is a country in which you can't do anything at 13 or 14 years old. You can't vote, you can't buy liquor, you can't drive a car, you can't do very much of anything without permission from somebody. You got to go to school, all of this, but you can be tried and deemed an adult in the United States of America. That's because of the three strikes 1994 bill. You had mandatory sentences that went from, instead of maybe doing a couple of years, you were doing 10, 15, and 20 mandatory years. And for the third strike in California, for example, you would get 25 years to life. I don't care how little and small it might be, they've changed the law and they've ameliorated things, but that's what it was. And then we have from that the rise of the so-called prison industrial complex. We have the development, proliferation of private prisons. We have the school policing that has turned into a pipeline to prison. And from 1994 to 2004, the prison population in America doubled. And that's because of Bill Clinton's 1994 crime bill, for which he has recently said he thinks that it was probably too much, and he's kind of sorry about it. But as a result of that bill, you have millions of little bees. And so the question is, why is that? Because when we think about crime, we often think of crime as some type of a moral question. Well, we know it's not a moral question, it's a political question. You can kill with impunity. You can kill, you go to Afghanistan and kill a bunch of people, nobody's gonna do anything but give you a medal. You're not gonna go and kill somebody. You can go to Libya and kill Gaddafi, and all they're gonna do is ask you about Benghazi. You can do a number of things. So killing is not a crime. It's only a crime if we say it's a crime. So, for example, you have the difference between the sentencing of blacks and whites. I remember the case of Kip Kinkle at the time of Michael's conviction. Kip Kinkle was a young white guy, 14 years old, in Eugene, Oregon. And Kip got up one day, killed mom, dad, and stuck them all up underneath the house, went off to school with a backpack full of handguns, an assault rifle, and a knife taped to his chest, and shot up 25 people. Five or three, six of them died. And the school, everybody was crying, you know, oh, this is horrible. And they had a big banner across the school the next day, and it said, why, Kip? Because that's how we think of Kip. We don't think of him as a criminal. He's not a thug. Kip is a kid. He was isolated in exurbia. Maybe he was watching too many violent video games. We don't know what happened to Kip, but he's a good kid that just did a bad thing. He killed mom, dad, 3 or 4 other people at school, and shot up 25 more. He's just a kid who had a bad moment. And we don't want him to go to prison like the little bees who are really criminals. And that's how we still see it. Not only whites, but blacks. But why are so many blacks then in prison? Do we think we have a criminal gene? There are people who actually studied this, believe it or not, as though crime were some sort of a behavioral or genetic problem. Something really wrong with black people? Now, either we believe that there is something wrong, and that we are, and little B was, as Hillary Clinton said, a super predator, whatever that means, or we know that something is wrong with the scheme of things in America. I want to talk about that for a minute. Now, sometimes people get nervous when I start talking about the history of black people, like, why? Why must we continue to talk about this subject? I'm bored. I'm tired. It's not me. It's not my fault. I'm sick of it. You know, let's move on. Even Obama says that. But Clinton certainly. What did you say?
I said you're amazing.
Yeah, I know, but you said something before and I didn't hear it. But anyway, so even Clinton, when we asked about reparations, said, that's too long ago. You're too long ago. People say, well, I'm suffering. You know, why should I pay for something I didn't do? I feel the same way. Why should I continue to pay for slavery? I need to be paid. I'm tired of working and so forth and so on. So if we want to have a correct analysis of how we got here, we do have to step back. And I want to say one more thing. When I lived in France in 1994, there was a case of a guy named Paul Touvier. And Touvier was put on trial. He was found. He had been living comfortably in Bordeaux. And Touvier was arrested and put on trial for the murder of thousands and thousands of Jews, but specifically in a small town outside of Bordeaux, because he was part of the Vichy government and so forth. And the French, who were really quite divided about their who don't like to acknowledge their anti-Semitism, you know, they talk about the question of the Muslim, but the French, if you ever lived there, there was an anti-Semitic thread running through France is quite interesting and dynamic and overt. So in any case, there were these big political arguments about why would they want to retry this guy Touvier? He's 90-some years old. The war is over. Let's get past this. And they said, let's turn the page of history. Can we just move on? You know how we say that today, but let's just move on. And the French prosecutor said something I like to quote. He says, we must turn the page of history, but before we turn it, we're going to have to write it. In other words, we got to acknowledge that something happened here, otherwise we act like it didn't happen, and then we can't adjust to what did happen. So when we look at the black experience, I'm not even going to go through the 250 years or the years before 1776 when the country was founded, but we have to know this. This country was founded as a slaveholding nation. Every single colony voted and acknowledged slavery. Even though some people in Massachusetts try to pretend they had nothing to do with it, but they made a lot of money off the slave trade along that northeastern seaboard. And blacks formed a slave class. We were black and we were a slave class. And all this was justified by the very architect of the Declaration of Independence, and one of the biggest slaveholders of his time was certainly Thomas Jefferson. And in Notes on the State of Virginia, Thomas Jefferson says, you know, we have to look into why the black can still be a slave when we have a country that's founded on the notion of the equality of all men, because he was a Francophile and the French were asking that question. Not that it really mattered to them, because they had colonies in Africa, they just didn't have blacks in France. But in any case, Jefferson says, but there's a difference. There's an inherent difference between the black and the white. Just the difference in their skin color, he says in Notes on the State of Virginia, the difference in their skin color, that immovable veil of black, not beautiful, like the admixture of red and white and white. And their hair is not long and flowing like our hair. And they have an odor or their body odor, and they tend to be lazy. And they have no music or art in them, and they don't love their women. They lust after them. And he goes on to talk about the similarities to the orangutan. And it goes on and on and on with all this scientific racism. And he concludes that I advance it, therefore, Jefferson says, that the black, and he used the word black, is inferior to the white in the endowments of both body and mind. And he says, we can't bring, these people are not equal to us because they're not human beings. They might become one. He said, we notice that there's always a difference. Whenever there's one pass of white blood, they get an improvement. So maybe they eventually they will improve. But right now, we can't bring them into our society. That's how the United States is formed. We have to know that and stop acting like we don't know that that's the core foundation. So when we get mad at Donald Trump, he's only appealing to the very core thing that started this country. Let's not get it too twisted. The only reason Republicans are mad is because he's exposing them. Matter of fact, everybody else is. He's saying what no everybody else has been holding on to for too long. They're happy to have it exposed. Thomas Jefferson said, he's quoting Jefferson. So many different ways. Just added in some Mexicans and some Muslims, but it was basically the same concept of the superiority of the white over others. That's who Thomas Jefferson was, and that's who Donald Trump is. I'm trying to figure out what the difference is. By 1860, just before the war was about to start, Civil War, the United States had built up its agrarian economic base on the backs of African slaves to a point where the United States was second only to Great Britain and France in manufacturing. And by 1863, after the war started, the Confederacy was winning the war. Lincoln says, wait a minute, we're going to have to do something. The tide of war has to be shifted. I'm going to free, as a necessary war measure, I'm going to issue this Emancipation Proclamation and free the slaves in the seceding states. In other words, if you will come back to the Union, I might let you keep your slaves. I just don't want them to expand to the new rise of the industrialization and the robber barons that I represent, like the Pullman Car Company. I don't want that to happen, but I'm not against, he said, I like any man understands and believes in the superiority of the white race. This is Lincoln, there's many things like that. But by 1860, when he issues that proclamation, blacks begin to leave the plantations and find Sherman, General Sherman. He burns Atlanta. He had so many black people following him, hundreds and hundreds and thousands of black people walking behind Sherman when he burned Atlanta and marched with him to the sea, to Savannah, and the war was over. And Sherman said, what are we going to do with these 4 million slaves? The theory is they're supposed to be free. And so he said, I'm going to issue field order number 15. I want all this land I just confiscated. I want it to be divided up into 40-acre plots and given to each one of these slave families, if they had a family, which of course is another whole conversation because we didn't really have a family structure. And he did. He gave people little certificates, and they had people actually moved in on that until after Lincoln was killed. Andrew Johnson said, I know good and well you don't think you're going to be back on this. We're going to reconstruct this South, and that means that you, the black people, are not going to be on these little plots, so you're going to get off. Now, what are we going to do with them? And what they did was they created the black codes in the southern states, which checked the behaviors of blacks and criminalized blacks. And so that black people, for example, who didn't have a job, would get arrested and then have to do work since they had no big prisons. So, and the idea was anyway to use the black labor and free labor. And as Douglas Blackman in his book, The Reenslavement of the Black, talks about it, we were reenslaved and we went from being a slave class to a criminal class, building up the steel mills, coal mines, and so forth and so on for the next several decades. By 1896, in the Homer Plessy case, we have the courts, the highest court of the land, giving full weight to keeping blacks from having any opportunity in America. Homer Plessy was what he called himself, an octoroon, meaning he had 1/8 black blood. I don't know what that means, but he was so white, black people thought he was white. We usually can see when black people are black. But anyway, Homer Plessy gets on a train in New Orleans. They put him off. He sues the train station and so forth. Ultimately, he ends up in the Supreme Court. And he says, why can't I sit in the same cars that are nice and beautiful like the whites do? And why must I sit in the back in steerage or with animals or what have you when I paid the same price? And the court said, well, he said, first of all, I'm more white than black, so I should definitely be up with the white people. And the court said, we deem you black, Plessy. You're going to have to come up with another argument. And Plessy's other argument was, I paid the same price. I should have the same accommodation. And the court said, you're right, Plessy, but we can't make these white people accept you. So we're going to say that as long as accommodations are equal, they can be separate. Now, there was something wrong with that that nobody seemed to notice. Don't notice it today. And that is, there are no cars being built for black people. So if the cars, the beautiful cars are being built and only white people can sit there, you don't have another car, and we didn't have any railroad lines. That's what Booker T. Washington said. We're going to have our own businesses, our own economy. That's why Marcus carved that. And so the struggle for our survival began after that. How do we survive Plessy and Jim Crow? How do we get housing? How do we get food? How do we get education? How do we get health care? How do we do anything? We are this lost group of people wandering around America with nothing. Zero. 1896. So we have Booker T. Washington. Let's start here in Tuskegee, build our own economy. Marcus Garvey coming from Georgia, coming from Jamaica, and saying in the spirit of Booker T. Washington, we can create our own economy. And so we struggled. NAACP, we need to integrate Du Bois. We need to use the talented tent to make ourselves better. Then we get the first immigration. People say black people didn't walk. The first migration of black people walked to Detroit to work for Henry Ford and develop the first mass manufacturing of cars in America, transforming the color and the population of Detroit. And then with World War II, that was World War I. With World War II, the second great migration, and one of the biggest places where blacks migrated was to Oakland and also here at Marin City. Marin City rapidly built itself up in 1942 in one single year to house 6,000 or 20,000 migrants. After the war, the only people that stayed, or most of the people that stayed, were the blacks because they couldn't live anywhere else in the county. So we have Marin City. That's what we did to try to just survive, find a job, go here, go there. We're locked out of the unions, created the only union we ever had, the sleeping car porter. We thought there was going to be this double V campaign, that there would be victory overseas, over there, and victory at home, the end of Jim Crow, but it didn't work. After World War II, we were in the same position, if not worse. We had just had a different shift in population and where we were. We had more and more people going north, but that was it. So by 1954, blacks started seeking freedom through education, and you have the great case of Brown versus Board of Education, where little Linda Brown's father tried to send her to school. And the court ruled ultimately that the segregated school was a violation of the equal rights protection, and that blacks, that the schools had to be desegregated. We already know the stories of the blood that was shed to enforce Brown from 1954 forward, and it has never been enforced. And as a matter of fact, we're on the reversal where schools have been desegregated. All that blood. Little Ruby Bridges, remember that Norman Rockwell painting where that little girl with the pigtails, that little dress her mother sent out there to school in New Orleans, and she was the only child in the class, and it spat upon so much you could take the spit and wring it out of her little dress. And we fought to be educated because we thought if we desegregated schools, we would get an education and we could figure out how to be something in a place that had been closed off to us in every single way. We thought that we could have desegregation as a path to freedom. Next year, you had the great case of Rosa Parks, and on the bus in Montgomery, Alabama, like Plessy on the train in New Orleans, trying to get a seat. Don't own a train, don't own a bus, just get a seat. And then we had the introduction of the moral voice of King saying, I can't believe this is the land of the free, home of the brave. Look at this. And King comes out, forms SCLC, and begins this powerful movement, echoed with the voice on the other end of things as they thought of it, of Malcolm X with the Nation of Islam, calling for freedom, calling for justice. You had all these other organizations in the freedom movement, SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and CORE, and the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, led by the wonderful Fannie Lou Hamer, talking about she was sick and tired of being sick and tired. And in 1963, of course, the Great March on Washington, which led to the 64 Civil Rights Act, and with Bloody Sunday in 65, from the march from Selma to Montgomery, we got the Voting Rights Act after 100 years after the 13th Amendment. Black people could drink out of a water fountain in a public place and could vote. Think about it. That's already in 1965. 66, the Black Panther Party starts. We advocated black liberation through revolution, though. We believe we were a Marxist-Leninist organization. We believed in that revolution had to occur, that whole overturning, and a new scheme had to be introduced. We made coalitions with other groups, ethnic groups, Brown Berets. We helped to form the Brown Berets. and made a coalition with the American Indian Movement, whites, poor whites in Chicago with the Young Patriots, Puerto Ricans in New York and Chicago, the young lords, Chinese, the Red Dawn. We were the only organization that called for, that stated that that gay liberation and women's liberation was a part of our struggle and coalesced with every kind of group you can imagine. We're involved in the first Pride marches over in San Francisco. We coalesced with people from the Center for Independent Living who were disabled, also shut out of this society, no press. Everyone who had common ground with us, we saw that. We saw ourselves also throughout the world. And the position that we took, and we formed a coalition with the PAC in South Africa, with ZANU in Zimbabwe, with Frelimo in Mozambique, and elsewhere. And so we saw ourselves as creating a world movement, as part of a world movement that would begin to address the common ills that we all had and the common goals that we all had. And of course, we were targeted by the entire United States government, as expressed specifically by the FBI and its so-called COINTELPRO, counterintelligence program. But the interesting thing about it was, the same year that the Black Panther Party was declared the greatest threat to the internal security of the United States, which was the year that Dr. King was killed, we find that Dr. King was one of the greatest targets as an individual of the FBI. So we have to say, wait a minute, I can understand why they didn't like the Panthers, because we had these guns as though our guns meant anything to the guns of the entire armed forces of the United States. I can understand why they didn't like Malcolm X, but why was the government targeting Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.? And then we have to look at that. By the time the Black Panther Party collapsed in 1981, there hasn't really been a movement since. And so we have millions of little bees. I want to close by just talking about why was King targeted, because it gives us a picture of where we are today and why, how we got here. Because all the struggles that we waged in that 60s period and so forth and so on, you know, Dr. King was preached nonviolence in the sense of a strategy that we had to be active but nonviolent. We weren't trying to go out here and kill a bunch of people, because first of all, we weren't going to win, and secondly, he considered it immoral. That didn't mean you were supposed to sit around and do nothing. So he talks about, well, what do we do? And I would ask the same question today. Given what we now know, where do we go from here? And that was a great question that he posed in probably one of the greatest speeches of his life, as far as I'm concerned, in August of 1967 at the SCLC National Convention, because he was organizing what the Poor People's Campaign. And King says, and I'm going to read this, we must develop a program that will drive the nation to a guaranteed annual income, create full employment or create incomes. If our nation can spend billions a year to fight an unjust, evil war, it can spend billions to put God's children on their own 2 feet. Now, calling for a national guaranteed income is just about as treasonous as the government would consider it. He says the movement must address itself to restructuring the whole of American society. There are 40 million poor people, and we must ask the question why. And when you ask that question, you begin to question the capitalistic economy, he says. Now, when I say questioning the whole society, it means ultimately coming to see that the problem of racism, the problem of economic exploitation, and the problem of war are all tied together. We are dealing with issues that cannot be solved without the nation undergoing a radical redistribution of economic power. That was Dr. King. We forgot that Dr. King. We think about the one that talked about the little kids going up a mountain holding hands saying kumbaya, whatever it was. We have reduced him to a caricature. We forgot that's what he was aiming at when he was assassinated on April the 4th of 68. And then King powerfully concludes in this speech to the SCLC National Convention. And because he was a preacher, so he says, you know, one day a juror came to Jesus and he wanted to know what he could do to be saved. And he says, and King says, Jesus realized that if a man will lie, he will steal, and if a man will steal, he will kill. So Jesus looked at him and said, Nicodemus, you have to be born again. And so King concludes, he says, in other words, America's whole structure must be changed. A nation that will keep people in slavery for 244 years will exploit them and poor people generally economically. A nation that will exploit economically will have to have foreign investments and everything else, and it will have to use its military might to protect them. So what I'm saying today King says, is that we must say, America, you must be born again. Thank you. Thank you very much. So, if you got some questions, check one, two, three.
It's time for questions and answers. So, if you have questions, please step out into the aisle so I can bring the mic to you. And there'll be mics, two mics. Lauren is carrying one on the other side of the aisle. So, just come out to the aisle so that we don't have to pass the mic to you. We'll hold it for you. And if you have questions, this is the time to ask them. We have about 15 minutes of questions and answers. So, please.
Talked about Thomas Jefferson and from him to William Jefferson, Clinton, and since the Moynihan Report to Obama going to Howard and talking about pulling up your pants to the Howard students.
Right.
There seems to be this obsession with personal responsibility as a way to obfuscate systemic changes that need to take place, systemic racism and Catholic exploitation. So I was wondering if you could talk a little about that, about how we can divert our attention from the small fries, the over-patrolling and the criminalization and the sin disparity between people, everyday people, and the people in Wall Street or people committing crimes of a larger nature that are necessary, that are the real changes that need to take place. And the same thing with the sanitization of King. How do we find the true meaning of King's realizations at the end, connecting all these things together rather than just focusing on things from a perspective that keeps us separate rather than seeing the solidarity.
Well, I think that, when I went to law school, one of the first things we learned was if you want to understand a problem in America, just follow the money. So, when you have a whole people enslaved to build up the agrarian economy, then you have to know that it didn't necessarily start out as racism. That was sort of added in as a factor. Although, at the end, when many of the states had seceded from the United States, had their secessionist statements, they all talked about how blacks were really more fit for this kind of hard work than whites were, and so this made sense. Jefferson's justification for keeping blacks out of the thing, because he was a slaveholder. How was he going to operate Monticello without these slaves? So this is like, you asked me to give up my slaves, it's like Donald Trump and so-called illegal immigrants. You asked me to pay these people actual money. I was hoping they'd just come here and work for a little bit and just go on back to wherever the hell they came from and let it go like that. So a lot of this is money, and it's greed and all of that. And what does that and what creates that is, of course, the scheme that we're in. In other words, it's dog eat dog and all of that. It's social Darwinism. But one of the things that Huey Newton talked about in his analysis of the capitalist system was that when capitalism replaced feudalism, it was revolutionary. Because feudalism gave people divine rights, So at least we have rights like I brought myself up, Donald Trump, all these people. I brought myself up by my own bootstraps, all that kind of American notions of things. But the bottom line is that if you want to hold on to power, I'm not trying to share anything with you, and I will do everything I can to make sure that you don't get there. And it's like black people have ended up being pitted against Mexicans or Mexicans against black. I've heard black people tell me the Mexicans are taking our jobs. The Mexicans are taking our jobs. That is incredible to me. So the woman that first said that to me, I said, Helen, you haven't had a job in 15 years. What the hell job is a Mexican taking from you? But what job is it that you want? You got black men. I had black men tell me that the problem with the black community was that black women were getting the jobs that black men should have. I said, what are you talking about? All my family members, I grew up in a house of women, my mother, my aunt, my grandmother, all of them scrubbed floors for white people for a living. And I never saw any of you going out to scrub anybody's floors. Is that the job you want? And he said, no, you know what I mean, corporate jobs. So I said, so you are mad because the corporate CEO likes me better than he likes you. So you should probably take that up with him. That's how stupid we've all become. And it's because we don't have an analysis and we don't understand and we don't want to look at what's real. It's like right now, all these people that love Hillary Clinton, they don't want to think about how she killed Gaddafi. They don't want to think about that. What does Gaddafi mean to me? They don't even know. They don't see the interconnections. So part of this is people truly are ignorant and people are like, I'll just take what I can get out of this system. And if that means cutting your throat, I'm ready to. So the culture of greed, the culture of exploitation is here. I want to say this, that, you know, I have a nonprofit called Open the World Enterprise, and our goal is to launch and sustain businesses for cooperative ownership by formerly incarcerated people and other people facing extreme barriers to employment, which includes not only people of color and poor people, but people who are disabled, who are not also facing very extreme barriers to employment, have no other way but to have their own business. And recently, last week, one of the people that works at our farm, we started our first business with the Urban Farm. We acquired a piece of property in West Oakland. Where's my West Oakland sisters? Anyway, started a piece of property, have a piece of property there. And we said, and he was arguing about his pay and his salary. And people were like, well, he wasn't pulling. And nobody got that this was supposed to be something where we could pull each other up together, right? Nobody, they'd rather fight. But this is all a cultural question. And it arises from getting these few crumbs. I want to say this is just an analysis. I saw this film called Rollerball, and there was a dumb one that was done afterward with LL Cool J or somebody like that, who was a Republican. But anyway, isn't that sad? But anyway, it was James Caan, it's many years ago now. Anyway, the idea was that the world had become, all the nations had broken down. And it was just two classes of people. There was the executive class and everybody else. Sounds familiar, kind of, huh? And so the world had, you know, everybody was basically living an okay life. Nobody was really sick. Everybody could get their, you know, bodies fixed or whatever it was. Everybody could live in a halfway decent place. So it was kind of like middle class life throughout the world kind of thing. And so a lot of problems had been resolved. There was no more war and all of this. But they had rollerball, and it was the international sport, or the sport of the world. And they had stadiums with a million seats in it, stuff like this. And what the rollerball was is these people would go around, they'd roll around this big court on, you know, what do you call it, skates, big skates, and they would throw something, it was like a basketball, but then they had these gloves on that could smack you and kill you. So it was like this very strange combination of violent sports, football, basketball, the worst of every sport. And people would get killed. And so James Caan played one of the top rollerball players in the world, and his friend got killed. He had the top kills for that year. But when his friend got killed, he said he didn't want to play anymore. Anyway, the short of it is, so he said he didn't want to play. So somebody from the executive class, which we learned about, came to him and said, how are you going to tell us you're not going to play? This is what you were born to do. We cultivated you to play rollerball. What the hell is wrong with you? And he was like, what do you mean? He started looking stuff up. He couldn't find a library, couldn't find any references. Everything was synthesized down into these two and three sentences of the history of the world, you know. And they said, well, and so he went to his girlfriend and said, you don't get it. Everything here, the executive classes provide you because you play rollerball. Even me. I got provided to you. He said, well, what is it? What happened? I don't understand what happened. Don't I have a right not to play? She said, no, you don't have a right. 50 years ago, people had a chance to vote for freedom or comfort, and they chose comfort. And that's what you have going on here. I'd rather sit here and not think about how Nikes are being made by Vietnamese women for $2 a damn day. I'd rather buy Nikes and pay $250 for a pair of shoes that's worth nothing intrinsically, not to count the labor history. I'd rather just not worry about NAFTA or anything else. These things are too big for me to wear my career. If I could just get my car loan paid, keep my little insurance going, I mean, in the United States, getting these big crumbs from the system. You know, I don't really want to talk about Bernie Sanders, you know. Listen, what's his face? Why can't I think of his name? Trump is horrible, but you know, he appeals to some of us. I mean, this is where we are. So we have to figure out ways to change the dynamic, educate the people. And we don't just educate by talking, we educate by doing. So it's on us. We're right here. We can do something. You got San Quentin Prison 5 minutes from you. Might want to talk about the students here doing something connected. There's a lot of little programs up there in San Quentin. It's small. It's not the big picture. You know, like we thought, it was great hubris. We in the Black Panther thought, party thought, revolution in our lifetime. You know, it's like, now that we know, the world will be changed. And we did everything we could to do that, but we didn't do it. So I think that you have to regroup and rethink the situation and what are the conditions that we have, not what we'd like, and how do we move this agenda. I'm moving what I can as an individual, but I have no institutional capacity. I don't have the Black Panther Party anymore. I don't have a school base. I don't have any base. I have to hustle, keep it going, and try to create this core piece, but I'm doing it in West Oakland, and maybe it becomes a model. This is what I can do. And lastly, I want to say that one thing, when you get old like I am, you learn that, you know, it's just life right now. This is your life, but you got to put in work every day. Then you won't regret it. You may not win the world, but you will not regret having lived on this planet, because you know you put in time and put in work. You didn't sit around here and watch this stuff fall apart and say nothing. Yeah. You have a question? Oh, I didn't see. I can't see. Go right ahead with your question.
I have both a quick statement and as well as a question. I was thinking about Malcolm X and his assassination and the fact that he had just come back both from Hajj but also from making a lot of inroads in African countries there and bringing together people of all colors again for social justice and equality. And of course, soon thereafter was also assassinated. So interesting parallels with Martin Luther King. But the question I had for you was, as someone who sort of lived through an organizing movement and being a part of that, what kind of suggestions might you give to our students if they too wanted to begin to organize? You spoke briefly about that, but it was interesting to hear you talking about all of the different groups that you brought together around the nation, and maybe if you could just talk briefly about how you were able to accomplish that and get people talking to one another.
Yeah, well, I want to say this about Malcolm X. He had also come to start following Martin Luther King around, and there was a great moment in 1964, less than a year before Malcolm was assassinated, when you have a photograph of them smiling and shaking hands, which I think was a dangerous moment for everybody, for them at least. And it wasn't just people of all races, because he was a Muslim. And he just talked about how he could not be, how could he talk about the white devil when he had met whites who were Muslims. So he was also a Muslim, just so we get it, you know, get it straight. It wasn't just a question of diversity and let's all hold hands, get together and sing Kumbaya. That's not what he said. He started the Afro-American Afro-American Organization of Unity, which was very similar to what he learned from Kwame Nkrumah, who had started the Organization of African Union, Unity in Africa, which Gaddafi, many years later, picks up on, which was the whole reason that he was killed. But in terms of organizing, I mean, everybody asks us, well, how do we do this? We also had all these programs, you know, free breakfast program, free clinic. We had 30-some programs at one point, free shoes. We made shoes and gave them away. We had something called Fantasy Shoes in Oakland. I'm not making this up. So people say, how did you do it? Well, the first thing you can do is like how I acquired 3/4 acre of property in prime real estate at 7th and Campbell in West Oakland. Well, the first thing you have to do is want to do something. See, most people don't really want to do anything. I say to students all the time, well, it's like I just told you. You got Marin City being gentrified up the wazoo. This is a county which is one of the richest counties in America, where you have like 2% black people in, right? And you have about everybody else, they still have one of the highest, you know, per capita incomes, and yet you have this incredible prison, which is, you know, the stalwart of the California, the banner holder of the California prison system, sitting right here, overcrowded, all kinds of bad conditions, nobody's speaking about it. What does it take to organize yourself into saying, what can we do to change that dynamic? The first thing you have to do is want to even change it. Right? So if you don't care, what's the difference? We didn't go around and start talking to some brown people talking about, let's get together with some Mexicans. We said, we're going to start the Black Panther Party. And what is the correct analysis for how we can create the conditions for revolution? We weren't going to be the revolution. We were a small organization. Even J. Edgar Hoover said, nobody's scared of the Black Panther Party's guns. We had our little street patrols in the beginning. We had our self-defense as part of our commitment, that we would never allow ourselves, we would always defend ourselves against any attacks by the police, and we did in so many different incidents, it's almost unbelievable. But at the same time, we were only 13% of the American population. Even if every black person got involved in the Black Panther Party, we couldn't win a war, couldn't win a struggle against the oppressor when everybody else is happy with the oppressor, even though they may not have been. So we started out by organizing our own people around things like free breakfast, right? That was an organizing tool. We thought we were going to feed breakfast to all the children of America? No. We started out with these small things. We ended up at 200-some thousand children a week we were feeding across the country. We had like 48 chapters. And how did we get the money for that? We just went out and said, every chapter was told, have you started your free breakfast program yet? Because if you haven't, you have a problem. It's a very disciplined organization. So we had to have an organization, we had to have a base in the community, and we had to have an agenda, and we had an agenda. Our agenda was the liberation of black people. We articulated it in a 10-point platform and program. We had an ideology, it was Marxism and Leninism, you know, aided by and bolstered by the philosophies of Franz Fanon and Kwame Nkrumah, Mao Zedong, Fidel Castro, Che Guevara, so forth and so on. All of them were socialists, all of them were communists with a small c. Including in Frelimo, mostly African liberation struggles. So we read everything we could, and we had an ideology, we had goals, we had an agenda. So the question is, now that we have that, what do we do? And so to enforce that agenda, we had to have an analysis. What's the biggest thing that black people complain about? Hunger. So we started feeding people, and we started feeding people by going places and getting food and bringing it into the black community. This was not really complicated, you know? And so we did that. And then we started talking about free clinics. What is our medical care? Even today, here we are talking about Obamacare is the answer. Really? Seriously? My daughter works every day in Atlanta, and she cannot afford Obamacare. And she's a graduate of Spelman College. She'll have to pay a tax on that, won't she? What's that? I mean, I don't even get that stuff. So the point is, we said everyone has a human right to health care, so we started free clinics. Same thing with all the other things. And then we said, when we organized with the American Indian Movement and with the Brown Berets came out of the Black Panther Party. They said, we got the same problems you do in the Latino community. We said, well then, you need to form your own organization. And they did, called the Brown Berets. Water Beret had the same problem, free breakfast in East LA, so forth and so on. AIM, same thing, on the reservation. Same thing with poor whites in Chicago under Slim Coleman, which people just never realize because everybody thinks that the whites as allies or something that they think of today. It's like white ally. I don't know what that means. You got so many poor white people in America, if you ever talk to them, you finally get rid of Trump, but nobody wants to talk to poor white people. Because we don't want to act like there are poor white people in America. But all you got to do is hit the South, go outside of Atlanta, and you will see thousands and thousands of poor whites lining the highways in these various trailer camps. Jane Fonda got in trouble for saying that, but it's true. All into the hills and the mountains along Appalachia, right? What are they doing every day? Sitting around being damn poor with nothing. They have more welfare issues than blacks did when Clinton passed the welfare reform bill that not one feminist in America raised her voice against. So we just said, what do we have to do to get our agenda? And we said, we got to find common ground. So we found common ground with gays, with women's organizations. We had an organization we collaborated with in San Francisco called Coyote. I don't know if anybody remembers them, but that was a labor union of sex workers. And those women did not play. They were like, we're not going to be pimped. We're going to get some health care here, you know. And then they'd have the Coyote Ball, which I've gone to at least two of, you know, every year. And then we had the disabled group. That was all part of our struggle. What about the environment? Common enemy. You're messing up the whole environment. Black people would say, what are you doing with all these white people with the environment? Oh, melanin's going to protect you from nuclear fallout or something? Are you insane? This is our question, too. All of these things affect us. And so we just decided to do these things. But the one thing we had was the will to act. We had the will to act, and we had a duty. If you were in the Black Panther Party, you didn't have any choice. You got up every day with the idea from whatever sleeping bag or floor you were sleeping on, with one thing in mind, and that was to continue this struggle until we were either killed or died. And that's how we did it. So if people want to know, they have to first decide you want to do something, and then decide what it is you want to do, and suddenly it will occur to you how to do it. That doesn't mean you will be absolutely successful. We were destroyed. Black Panther Party was wiped out by the government. You know, people want to talk about Huey Newton and drug addiction and all this. That happened 10 years after the demise of the party. Nobody wants to, you know, let us not let facts get in our way, you know what I mean? So I think that if you want to do something today, you got to look at where you are and what you could be doing. And what do you think could be done to at least bring more and more people into this spirit of struggle that we really want to make change? I mean, we really are getting ready to vote between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. That's it. That's because democracy is a joke. Nobody gets that. Oh, maybe locally it is. Maybe on certain little local level, you know, city council or whatever it is, little commissions and stuff, day-to-day stuff that you need. But when you get to something as big as the presidency, first of all, who that's not rich is going to become president of America? That is to say, backed by money. You know what I mean? Even if you're not rich, you have to have some money to play the game. So this notion of you two can be president, you know, it's like Nas said, you two can be Oprah. You're not going to be Oprah. Not anybody in this room is getting ready to be Oprah. I'm telling you that right now. There's one slot and she filled it. You're not going to be president. There's what, 300 million people in America? I don't even know, what is the number these days? 300 million? 300 million people in America. All of us going to have a dream to be president. Like, oh, you can make your dreams come true. This is the kind of silly conversation we have, going back to what you said. You know, people are actually thinking, I too can be president. I'm going to take my heels together and I'm going to be president. Not counting why you'd want to be president and all that other stuff, but I'm just saying it's just not going to happen. So we have to have realistic goals, and the Black Panther Party did, except for when sometimes we were very filled with whatever, hubris, as I say. We thought we were the answer to everything. You know, we are the answer. We were not the answer. But we certainly had an agenda, and I think that's the main thing. I look at Black Lives Matter, and I like some of these young people a lot. I think they're really committed to something, but they don't know what they're committed to. They're just running around here, jumping around protests. You know, people block it. You block the San Francisco Bay Bridge, and what? What did that mean? People got mad. Most of the people that were driving to drive across the bridge got mad at you. That's not organizing people. That's just making some people. You want the workers to be on your side. You don't want to alienate the very people that you cared about, right? That you loved. So I'm saying that we have to have a correct analysis and we have to have the will to act. And I think that if people have that and the will to organize and to sublimate your individuality and your self-involvement, you know, one of the things we see today as part of that neoliberal culture is I got mine, I put myself up, it's too bad about you. Because America really is a place of opportunity and anybody can make it if you really try hard. That's how we think today, isn't it? We can really, if we really, really, really try hard and get my education and go do these things, everything's going to be all right. You know, and it isn't all right. Because as long as you have this many people in poverty in America and this many people who are suffering in so many different other ways, it is not all right. So I think the best thing to do is to get a plan, get an agenda, get organized, have an agenda and a goal, and then move on that and act on that goal. Lastly, I'll just say, you know, Che Guevara, whom we loved very much in the Black Panther Party, once said, one of the many wonderful things that he said, you know, words are beautiful, actions are supreme. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lane Brown. Thank you. Give her a huge hand again for her time and her words of wisdom.
This is Penguin Radio at radio.dominican.edu. You've been listening to the Unity and Diversity kickoff event with its keynote speech by Elaine Brown, former Black Panther Party leader. This evening's program is sponsored by the Diversity Action Group of Dominican University of California. The director of the Diversity Action Group and the dean of Diversity and Equity is Suresh Appavu. The event was also co-sponsored by Dominican's Black Student Union, whose president is Janessica Holliday. I'm DJ Noni here at Penguin Radio at radio.dominican.edu, which is brought to you by Dominican School of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences, where our dean is Dr. Laura Stivers, and our Communication and Media Studies chairperson is Brad Van Alstein. Our Penguin Radio executive director is Stuart Horn, and our managing director is Leona George Davidson. Thanks for listening to Penguin Radio at radio.dominican.edu.